Bloom Rosetta Casper with the splendid table. Today we're going to learn what it takes to create and keep alive a restaurant that's won acclaim for nearly three decades. We're talking with Alice Waters, creator of Chez Panisse in Berkeley, California. This is a woman who has redefined American cooking and in the process become a visionary, determined to change how our children eat. Our road food experts, Jane and Michael Stern, are in New York City feasting at Cafe Edison. Wine wit Joshua Wesson tips us off to California's new Provençal-style wines. Journalist Michael Ruhlman has advice from the CIA. And as always, we take your call. Don't you go anywhere. It's coming up on the Splendid Table. But first, this. Welcome to Kitchen Chronicles, where knowledge is power and cooking is pleasure, a practical guide to nourishing ourselves and the people we care about. Today, it's part two of our broth and soup mini-series. Danielle Steele would call it simmerings. There are so many different ways of making broth and soup, it's worth spending a few chronicles explaining some of them. A stash of good broth in the freezer is like money in the bank. Every 6 months or so, you set a big pot to simmer on the stove, and forever afterwards, at least for the next several months, you've the makings of great fast soups that can be a meal in a bowl, better-tasting stews and braisings, and really classy sauces. Homemade broth tastes better than anything from a can. It's far more economical and is absolutely free of fat and salt. And it's so good you'll want to eat it on its own. Last week I explained how to do a delicate, relatively fast cooking chicken broth. Today we're doing the big one, the power broth. It's got whole heads of garlic for big mellow flavor, and the broth simmers from 12 to 14 hours to draw every single bit of taste and nutrition out of the meat and vegetables. If you're going to have only one fabulous tasting broth in the freezer, this is it. It's so packed with flavor you can dilute it. It's practically a sauce all by itself. So when you've done, let's say, sautéed chicken, you just swirl some of the broth in the pan to pick up the brown bits, and you've got a great sauce. Very little boiling down is necessary. Make a risotto with it, and you'll understand the huge difference between homemade stock and using canned in this kind of dish. And finally, just heat some up and sip a mugful. It's really delicious. So quickly, let's review broth-making basics. No matter what the recipe, here's the technique. Start with a big, tall pot so the broth doesn't evaporate away while it cooks. And then the first thing is, put in the meat and the poultry. Cover it with at least 3 inches of cold water. Starting in cold water encourages the meats to release proteins and nutrients into the liquid. Bring it slowly to a simmer. Skim off all the foam that'll rise to the surface, then add the vegetables. Partially cover and cook it. Keep it at a slow simmer, which means you can say the word 1,000 between each bubble. If you boil the broth, its fats get locked or emulsified into the liquid and the broth will be greasy. From time to time, stir the broth and skim off the fat. With power broth, you're going to need 12 to 14 hours of cooking, so make it on a Sunday when you'll be hanging around the house. Once it's done, let the broth cool a little, strain it, chill it fast, like setting it in a bowl of ice or on the back porch if it's cold outside. The easiest way to get rid of every speck of fat is to refrigerate the broth overnight. The fat gets hard on the liquid surface and it comes off with no effort. Now you can freeze it. So, here are the specific secrets that make power broth so powerful. Use turkey wings from birds raised on organic feed without hormones or antibiotics. We're making a broth from this meat, so we want it to be really good for us. Why wings? Turkey wings are cheap, and wings are neither light nor dark meat, but a combo of the two of them. They make great tasting broth. Figure 1 to 1.25 pounds for every 2 quarts of water. So if you have a 12-quart pot, it's 6 to 7 pounds of wings. If the pot is half full of wings, you've got the right amount. Number 2, chop up the wings with a cleaver so you crack the bones to get all the possible nutrients out of them. Number 3, use organic vegetables. onion, celery, carrot, but mostly onion. Figure 2 medium onions for every 6 quarts of water. Figure in 6 quarts of water, you want 1 big carrot and 1 big stalk of celery. If vegetables fill the pot by 1/3, you've got the right measurement. Now for the ingredients that separate this broth from the rest of the pack. 4 to 5 big heads of garlic that you cut in half, whole heads. Now you're not going to taste garlic in the broth. They just give it lots of body and depth. And for every 12 quarts of liquid, you want 4 canned tomatoes. Their acid sweetness gives the broth an appealing edge. So make power broth this weekend and join us again for the next edition of Kitchen Chronicles. Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, a show about food, enjoying it, buying it, cooking it, and about eating out, entertaining, health, and travel. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Club Wed Gift Registry at Target, offering the latest cooking tools and gadgets, from colanders to ladles to timers and garlic crushers. Target has the selection of cooking tools to fully outfit your kitchen. Our program is produced by Minnesota Public Radio and Tom Vagley Productions and is distributed by PRI, Public Radio International. One of my favorite people is joining us today, Alice Waters, creator of California's Chez Panisse restaurant. Alice is called the mother of California cuisine, but she's more than that. She's a visionary who's fostered a new American philosophy of eating. We're going to learn how an exceptional restaurant can keep flourishing over nearly 30 years and how Alice Waters works. Wine maverick Joshua Wesson has some new finds, California Provençal. It seems American winemakers are echoing the tastes of southern France, with some good results. Joshua tells us what to look for. Journalist Michael Ruhlman attended one of the country's top restaurant schools. It's called the CIA, Culinary Institute of America, and he has some advice for home cooks from his experience. As always, the second half of the show, we open the lines for your calls. Anything you want to talk about, the number is 800-537-5252. So let's get things rolling with that great road food duo, Jane and Michael Stern. They write the Two for the Road column in Gourmet Magazine. Jane, Michael, you two are so near New York. Have you got any ideas? Where should we go to eat in New York?
Weirdly enough, yes, we do. As you know, of course, you know, back roads and far-off destinations are our thing. But when we do go to New York and when we do go to Midtown, specifically West 47th Street, we go to one of the lesser-known and most wonderful places to eat. Real Jewish home cooking in New York called Cafe Edison. It is the place that makes the best homemade cheese blintzes in the world.
Huh. Now, I mean, you hear about places like, you know, Katz's Delicatessen or the Second Avenue Deli. Better?
For pastrami sandwiches, I would go to Katz's. And for chopped liver, I would go to the Second Avenue Deli. But for crabby waitresses and good blintzes, I would go to Cafe Edison.
And homemade gefilte fish. And not only homemade gefilte fish and cheese blintzes and really good borscht, but celebrities galore. I mean, this is where Neil Simon has his own table. We saw William Burroughs eating there a number of years ago. David Copperfield, the magician, was eating there. But this is not at all a celebrity hangout in that it's not, there are no, let's say, you know, corned beef sandwiches called the Buddy Hat or the Joan Rivers. This is where writers like August Wilson, playwrights like August Wilson, really go to just cool out, eat blintzes and sour cream, and write. I mean, you actually see some of the top writers from Broadway and books sitting at tables writing in longhand as they're scarfing down their borscht.
The other thing you have to understand about this place is that it's how can I put it? It isn't what it used to be. The Cafe Edison is in the Edison Hotel, which was once a very fancy hotel.
Well, the cafe is what it used to be. The food is wonderful. The hotel has seen finer days.
Well, it's in the ballroom. It's in what used to be the ballroom of the Edison Hotel. So it's got beautiful kind of bas-relief on the wall, and it's kind of, but it's all a little faded, and above the bas-relief is, you know, be sure to try our bagels. So it's a wonderful sort of cross-cultural mix.
It's kind of like, a third-tier hotel that tourists from out of town would stay at, but I don't think the tourists from out of town know that the cafe, which is right next to it, is where one of the truest New York experiences is. And maybe they wouldn't know what homemade gefilte fish and, you know, handmade cheese blintzes were either. But
Well, tell me more about these blintzes, because I love blintzes.
Well, if you love blintzes, which I could just live on, I mean, that would be my, sort of last meal going to the electric chair. You know that they're very hard to make because a blintz is, a crepe basically filled with sweetened pot cheese and fried, then sort of folded over and fried and then topped with sour cream. And it's a deceptively difficult thing to make. When I've tried to make homemade blintzes, they just fall apart. And as my Jewish mother said, they're all ungepatschkat, which means that they're just this big falling apart mess. But the people at Cafe Edison make these big, plump, bursting with wonderful sweet cheese and delicate crepes. I don't know how they do it. I mean, it's in my heritage to make these correctly, and I can't.
And if you don't finish them, the waitress will be sure to scold you for not having done so.
But that's never been a problem with me, Lynn. I've not only finished my own, I finished Michael's, and I finished the person who was joining us to eat there a couple of weeks ago.
Hey, you two, thank you.
Do you miss New York? The anger, the action. Does this laid-back lifestyle lack a certain satisfaction?
Jane and Michael Stern are authors of Eat Your Way Across the USA and Chili Nation. Every week they join us here at the Splendid Table, and every week you can get their restaurant finds on our website at splendidtable.org.
Tell me, do you miss New York? Me too. Me too.
Wine wit Joshua Wesson has joined us in the studio. Hi, Josh.
Hi. I'm in a reverie right now. I'm in a Provençal reverie, so don't disturb me.
Well, this is what I want to talk about.
Well, that's good because I just had a trip to Provence cancel on me, so I'm the best I can do is drink the wines of the region, or wines that resemble the wines of the region, and then float away there.
Well, now when you say this, you bring to mind something I've been seeing. Now, California has long tried to imitate wines from other parts of the world. I mean, obviously Bordeaux and Burgundy, they're doing Italian up the Kazoo. But now we're seeing wines from the south of France, these Provence wines you mentioned. Well, tell me about these. I mean, are they real and are they good? I mean, let's be blunt about it. Are they worth it?
You know, it's funny. There were a bunch of Rhone Rangers that came marching through California planting traditional Rhone grape varieties like Syrah and Marsanne and Roussanne and Viognier, and took the wine world by storm. And now they're looking for the next new thing, and the next new thing seems to be grapes coming out of Provence. And since almost all of Provence is red, and we think of rosés from that region, but
right,
90% of the wines that one finds in that part of France are either pink or red. It gives red wine lovers and most California wine producers, if you back them into a corner, will say they love red more than white, are really excited about mixing it up with Provençal tastes and Provençal flavors and Provençal grapes.
What is how does a Provençal wine taste? What's the profile of that taste?
Well, sometimes people are taken to poetry and they get lofted on imaginative references to thyme and fennel and pine and anise and all those things wafting up from a glass when they close their eyes. But in fact, when you take the traditional red grapes of Provence, which are surprisingly Cabernet Sauvignon, Mourvèdre, Sanceaux, and Syrah, and you mix them up in just the right way, you can definitely suggest those different flavors and aromas coming from a glass. So it is a potentially poetry-filled glass of wine that one can have from there. And I think that there are a number of California producers that are doing a very fine job conjuring up some of that poetry out of grapes coming from the other side of the big pond.
So who are they?
Well, my favorite of the moment is one of the easiest to find. It's Klein Cellars, and they're making a lot of Rhone-style wines, and since the Rhone sort of lazily leads into Provence, they also make some Provençal-style red wines. They're Mourvèdre in particular, and Carignan from Old Vines, one of the few producers in California that actually has some history growing these grapes. It's not just the flavor of the month to them.
Mm-hmm.
They do a great job, and I'm really enamored of their Old Vines Carignan, and it's not terribly expensive. It sells for about $15 a bottle, and in the great scheme of things, compared to what Viognier and a lot of other fairly rare wines out of California can go for, it's almost a steal. I also like wines coming from the Napa Valley, and Jade Mountain is probably the best-known producer of Provençal-style wines. They actually have a wine called La Provençal, and it's a lovely red blend, and it's just a very tasty mix of the grapes that I mentioned before.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, they're sort of the old guard along with Klein, and the new kids on the block are coming from down south, surprisingly, from Santa Barbara, and a winery called Jaffers, and they are almost completely dedicated to the Rhone and Provence, and they make a blend of Syrah, Mourvèdre, and Cabernet, which is a stone-cold stunt double for a top Provençal Rouge.
Hmm. So what's the name of that wine, by the way?
They call it the Jaffers Cuvée. Or the Matelia Cuvée. They make two, and they're both really stunning wines. They're a little bit more expensive than the Klein. They come in at around $20-$22 a bottle, but I still think that they offer tremendous value because they are handmade wines, very rare in the great scheme of Provençal style blends in California, and they're the top of the pops. They get highly rated, so it's unlikely that you'd find those wines outside of large markets in the United States, but if you ask for Jaffers, J-A-F-F-U-R-S, or you go to a website like Virtual Vineyards, you'd probably have a good shot at finding some of those wines.
Joshua, thank you.
My pleasure.
This is one of those songs with completely indecipherable lyrics. Now, for the record, what they're really saying here is, spill the wine, take that pearl, not what I always thought they were saying, which was, do I dig that girl? Joshua Wesson is president of Best Sellers Wine Shops. You can get his advice on Provençal-style California wines on our website at splendidtable.org. Coming up, Alice Waters, the mother of modern American cooking, with her take on how to run a restaurant. Inside advice from the CIA, that's the Culinary Institute of America, in case you were wondering, and your calls. Get on the line. The number is 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. This is The Splendid Table, distributed by PRI Public Radio International. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, a show about life's appetites. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Target, dedicated to helping you discover new and exciting ideas that help you enjoy everything there is about cooking for your friends and your family. Just like you do here at The Splendid Table each week, online at Target.com. Very few restaurants have continually won acclaim and served top-notch food for 28 years. But Chez Panisse has. Alice Waters created Chez Panisse in 1971 and continues to run it today. She's called the mother of modern American cooking, and she's a fierce advocate of organic and sustainable agriculture. Alice is a visionary who's now set out to change the way our children eat with her edible schoolyard program. But when you stand back and try to analyze what makes Alice Waters, everything seems to begin with the restaurant. Her latest book is the Chez Panisse Cafe Cookbook, and Alice has joined us in the studio today. Alice, welcome.
Thank you very much.
Alice, I want to talk about the story of how Chez Panisse began. How did you start this?
Well, I think the beginning was in France. I went to France when I was 19, and I'd never really eaten any food before then. So that it was a kind of a revelation for me to be in a country where food was so important. And to walk through the marketplace in the morning when I was headed for school.
Mm-hmm.
And to go out and to visit in the countryside, and every little restaurant that I went in was so charming and so delicious that the seeds for this idea were planted very deeply in that experience. So when I came back home, I wanted to eat like that. I wanted to live like that. And I thought, well, there's no place to eat. I think I'll just open a little place like that. It was that naive an idea. I guess a lot of it came from Berkeley in the 60s, and that idea that if you made some place that was good, people would come. So I borrowed about $10,000 from friends, and I had a couple of partners, one that had some experience cooking, fortunately, and so we leased a house that was in our neighborhood, and I gathered around friends who said that they wanted to work there, paid them $5 an hour. From the very beginning, I thought they should be paid well, but the meal cost $3.95 when we opened up.
You mean a meal at Chez Panisse at that time was $3.95
uh-huh. for a four-course uh-huh. meal. We opened at 7 in the morning and opened till 2 a.m. And, of course, no one came before 10 in the morning, and no one came after 10 at night.
But were you there all that time?
I was there all that time. And it was one menu a day. You know, it was a fixed menu. Every day was a big proposition because we had never cooked in big quantities like that. And mm-hmm. I was very, very critical about the ingredients and the taste. So it took us 8 hours, if you can imagine, to dry the lettuce because I wanted only the hearts out of the romaine, and they had to be washed in a certain way, and then they had to be laid out on towels on individual layers and put in the bus tubs into the refrigerator. And it really took 8 hours for one person to do that.
At what point, because this is very different from the way most restaurants are run, at what point did it start to take off?
Well, it was probably 8 years before we were really in the black. I wasn't paid for the first 8 years.
Did it change? I mean, were there realities you had to deal with that you didn't like, that this isn't what you wanted?
Well, I had the idea that I was going to be able to sit down every night and eat dinner with my friends. Well, I didn't see them for 10 years, I don't think. I was in the kitchen.
Mm-hmm.
And people who work in the restaurant are cooking when other people are relaxing. We forget about that. They're the ones that are waking up at the crack of dawn and making bread.
Mm-hmm.
And they're the ones who can't eat with their family at dinner time, because the restaurant business is very intense, particularly on the weekends, on Friday and Saturday nights. And so most people who work in the restaurants have maybe Sunday and Monday off.
You are famous among the food community in the United States for your pickiness, your obsession with the way the ingredients you use in the restaurant are raised. How do you source for there's the Café and Chez Panisse. How do you source the ingredients, the materials you use?
Well, we have a sort of a very extensive group of farmers and ranchers that we connect with on a daily or weekly basis. But we never know what we're going to really cook until that week before. We want to know what is coming out of the garden that week that day.
Mm-hmm.
And plan the menu accordingly. And that's how it works. We don't think of the recipe first, we think of the food stuff first.
Is it true that your chefs actually go out and work with farmers?
A lot of them have. And part of our little tour, if you will, for the new people who come to the restaurant is to go up to the farm that we're associated with in Sonoma, go up on the ride to pick up the vegetables and experience the farm. And we take up the compost when we go and we bring back the vegetables. And usually that experience is very powerful for the people involved, whether they're waiters or whether they are cooks. And some of them want to go back up again and want to really work in the garden.
Mm-hmm. If there was one thing you had to tell me that sets apart what goes on in your restaurants from most others, what would it be?
Certainly the ingredients, the way that they're raised and farmed, although there are a lot of people who care about organically grown, the purity of the food. That,
mm-hmm.
That's something terribly important for me. But there aren't very many restaurants around the world that are obsessed in that particular way.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one part. But I think the other part is working in a collaborative way with the people in the kitchen. Which relates a little bit to the idea that these people are together all of the time and that they aren't having a life outside of the restaurant. The life is within the restaurant, and so you want to make that life as rich as possible for the people who are there. So I want to be able to see the sun from the kitchen, because I don't have time to go out and watch the sunset. So I took down the walls between the kitchen and the dining room so that we could take advantage of that. I want to be connected with the day. I don't want the restaurant to be in the basement of a building. I couldn't imagine working in a restaurant in the basement. I want it to be part of the whole experience that people have, and so that the cooks can relate to the customers who come in. Well, that's what the open kitchen is about. I want it to be beautiful in the kitchen. I want smells to be good. It's a sensual experience, and I want to have a meal. I would love to have room enough to have a big table for the whole staff to eat together.
Alice, what about this as a life for someone who is starting out in the restaurant world?
Well, I think that if you see the restaurant business as a way of nourishing people, if you see it as a way of nourishing yourself in the process and your family, it can be incredibly rewarding. Somehow we've understood food in a very different way in this country in restaurants. And they're run like factories, and, you know, food is manipulated in many, many ways. But if we get back to the real roots of it, and if we think about those small family-run places that we loved all over Europe, that way of life is something that can be very, very meaningful and beautiful, inspiring.
Mm-hmm.
It may not be, you know, a way to make a fortune, but it's a beautiful way to express yourself and to care for people.
Alice, thank you.
You're welcome.
You can get anything you want at Alice's restaurant. You can get anything you want at Alice's restaurant. Walk right in, it's around the back, just a half a mile from the railroad track. You can get anything you want at Alice's restaurant.
Alice Waters Restaurant Chez Panisse is in Berkeley, California. Her latest book is the Chez Panisse Cafe Cookbook. Alice left us with a recipe for you. It's a French classic, brine-cured pork. You can get it two ways. Either send a self-addressed stamped envelope to the Splendid Table, care of Minnesota Public Radio, St. Paul, Minnesota, 55101. That's the Splendid Table, care of MPR, St. Paul, Minnesota, 55101. Or go to our website at splendidtable.org.
Secret Agent Man, Secret Agent Man, they're giving you a number and taking away your name.
No, 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 not that CIA. Michael Ruhlman is author of The Making of a Chef. He went to the Culinary Institute of America, the CIA, as a journalist to write about what went on behind those swinging kitchen doors. But he fell in love with the craft and came out a chef. We talked to Michael about what he learned there that would apply to the home cook.
The most important thing that I learned was that cooking is not all sorts of fancy shenanigans in the kitchen. Cooking is not a bunch of recipes. Cooking is not fancy ingredients. Cooking is all about method and formula and ratios. You learn methods to perfect the sauté. So you learn braise. Before I went in, I thought of beef stew, lamb shank, and osso buco as different things.
Mm-hmm.
When I came out, I now think of them and know them as the very same thing, just using different ingredients. They're braised items. With a braise, there is a method. You sear the meats, you brown the vegetables, you add your stock, your braising liquid, and you cook it until when you stick a fork in, there is no resistance, and that's called fork tender. That is all you need to know. That's everything you need to know about braising. You can learn the rest by practice. So that's an example of a method
mm-hmm.
that extends. Now you can make blanquette de veau, you can make chicken fricassee, you can make pot roast and make it great because you know the method. The second thing that I learned that was fundamental is ratios. These are just simple formulas that you can use that to broaden your repertoire and to understand cooking. For instance, a ratio is 1 yolk to 8 ounces of oil. Now, when you whip that together and create an emulsified sauce out of that, it's called mayonnaise. But if you know how to do that, if you know how to make a regular mayonnaise, and you don't even need to look in a book for this, 1 yolk, 8 ounces of oil, you know how to make a mayonnaise. You whip that together, it forms a beautiful emulsion called mayonnaise. Now, once you know that, then you can make, a lime mayonnaise for some coriander grilled chicken, say. You can make a remoulade for calamari. You can make a whole grain mustard mayonnaise just by adding mustard to this for a great potato salad. You can make a classic aioli. Just to understand what a pure mayonnaise is with fresh, good quality olive oil is an extraordinary thing. Or you can use walnut oils. There's a million different things you can do by knowing this one little thing, this 8 ounces of oil for one yolk, and understanding the behavior. It's all about method. It's learning one thing that translates to 1,000 other things. Learning how to make one perfect sauce can translate into 1,000 perfect sauces. Learning how to make soups. You don't learn how to make a specific soup. You learn how to make a clear soup and a creamy soup and a pureed soup. And therefore, you know how to make cream of broccoli, cream of asparagus, cream of fava bean, if you want, because you know the method of how to make a cream soup.
Can we pick up this information, learn this information, without going to the CIA? I mean, are there any people out there who are writing this way or teaching this way?
That's a great question. I haven't seen anybody do this. The CIA has a textbook called The New Professional Chef. It's a wonderful textbook cooking book, but it talks in a professional kitchen language, so it may not be accessible to the home cook.
Uh-huh.
But I would, if I were a home cook who wanted to perfect my basics, I would either find a chef in town who is teaching such classes, because they do exist,
mm-hmm.
or I would go through a basic book and understand what these fundamentals are.
It sounds like your home cooking essentially became more logical for you. Got easier, right?
It got easier and broader. I was focusing on, I learned to taste at the CIA. Here's another thing. I learned to season food properly, and I learned how to taste properly. I learned what a good stock was versus a bad one, or a muddy stock was. And you can, this is what a culinary education can do that you can't get from a book. A chef will make a good veal stock, and he'll say, this is what a good veal stock tastes like. Recognize it. Know what it is. Know how it got that way. And here is what you can do with a good veal stock. And he put together a sauce Robert, which is reduced veal stock, basically thickened and flavored with mustard and reduced wine and some shallot. You need to know these things, or at least be aware that there is a perfect flavor, there is clarity of flavor and perfection of taste. I learned how to salt food properly. Salting food before you cook it is crucial, so that you don't taste the salt, but you get to learn the effects of salt, how food is affected by salt when it is salted at various stages of cooking.
Michael, thank you.
Thank you, Lynn.
Michael Ruhlman is author of The Making of a Chef. Okay, it's time for our weekly trivia question. Here it goes. What is the strangest question ever submitted to the General Electric Answer Center? I know this is a little odd, but life's like that. Again, the question is, what is the strangest question ever submitted to the General Electric Answer Center? We're going to be back in a moment with the answer to that burning question and your calls. Get on the line. The number is 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. This is The Splendid Table, distributed by PRI Public Radio International. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, a show for people who love to eat. We're taking your calls this hour at 800-537-5252, but before getting to the phones, I've got the answer to this week's trivia question. Once again, our question of the week was, what is the strangest question ever submitted to the General Electric Answer Center? You're never going to believe it. It is, can I defrost a chicken in the clothes dryer? Followed closely by, to save water, can I wash my clothes in the dishwasher? Such creativity. But look, let's get back to the chicken. There are proper ways to defrost any food. You can do it either in the fridge or on the counter. But here's how, okay? If you can plan ahead, defrost food in the refrigerator. Figure about 2 days for something like a 3-pound chicken. Just put it in the fridge and leave it there. Now, if you're in a hurry, there is method number two. Here, you defrost on the counter. What you do is you take a bowl, you fill it with ice water, and you put the food in the bowl. A 3-pound chicken will take probably an hour and a half to 2 hours, but you have to keep the water cold. Now, if there is one thing you take away from this discussion that I want you never to forget, you do not ever defrost any food at room temperature on the counter. This sets up the perfect incubator for harmful bacteria. And this is how people get food poisoning. So, defrost in the fridge if you can plan ahead, or in a bowl of ice water on top of the counter if you're in a hurry. But never defrost at room temperature. Phone lines are officially open. Let's talk. The number is 800-537-5252. Anything you want to talk about. Let's get started. We have Mike on the line. Hi, Mike. What's up?
Hi. I want to talk about cheese.
Cheese. This is a nice subject. We can spend the next 6 months talking about cheese. Do you have a specific thought about cheese?
Yeah, I sure do. About 20 years ago, I worked with a Yugoslavian lady in a bank.
Mike, excuse me, do you have your radio on or something?
No, you know what, I'm in a Chinese restaurant. Let me go to
Hey, what have you ordered?
You know, I had this shrimp with a baby Chinese eggplant, which is this very tender and light purple.
Ooh, whole eggplant? I mean, little whole eggplant?
Well, it's sliced, but it's very, very delicious. It's a wonderful, 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 wonderful dish.
Mike, what city are you in?
I'm in Mineola in Long Island, New York.
Oh, where are you eating?
It's a place called Tofu.
My favorite food. I think we better get back to the cheese.
Yeah.
It just sounds so
great.
I hope
I get a free meal now from the plug. But
this is good. We'll work on this.
So I worked with this Yugoslavian woman, and she said she went to a butcher and brought in this cheese she called Pashki.
Uh-huh.
And I've been looking for it intermittently for 15 years. It was a hard cheese, a little bit salty, but just delicious. And I have not found it anywhere. I'm just wondering whether this was a dream I had or...
Pashki, I have to confess, I don't know the hard version of a Pashki. And also, you know, with what's happened to the former Yugoslavia...
Right.
I don't know that we're going to be seeing very many of the cheeses for quite a long time, but there is, I'm trying to remember now, from another life, I mean a long time ago, I remember hearing about a Yugoslavian cheese, or it may have been Bulgarian, that was called Pashki Sir,
but
it was a fresh cheese. It was like a pot cheese almost.
My memory might be a little...
But you know what? You know what it may be? It may be, because I'm also thinking, isn't there that Russian sort of cheesecake that they make, I think, at Easter that begins with syllable,
Posh?
My knowledge of the languages of that part of the world is nil, but I just wonder if we're not talking about a word that means cheese or relates to it, and that's why the Posh comes in.
Right.
I don't know if I can help you for a source, but one thing to consider is, Steve Jenkins, our cheese guy, who you hear on here a lot,
right.
is, if you're in the New York area, he's at the Fairway Markets.
Oh.
And I'd say, now I'm going to tell you, go and bug Steve, for goodness sakes. Tell him to...
I had no idea he was so convenient.
Yes, he is. And he's at the Fairway Markets. And I'd say, you go and bug him. Tell him you want to find Poshke or something like Poshke.
Right. All right. Thanks very much.
Hey, thank you. And thanks for the tip on the restaurant. Enjoy the shrimp and eggplant.
Oh, it's so good. Thanks. Bye-bye.
Goodbye, Mike.
Bye.
The kind of cheese Mike is talking about, when he says it was salty and delicious, you know, it may relate to something like feta. I'm not saying it is a feta, but there's a sort of set process with the way cheeses are made. There's some way that the curd and the whey are separated. The curd is then pressed with most of its moisture being pressed out of it, and often it goes into a salt bath. And how long it stays in that salt bath varies from cheese to cheese. And then the cheese is aged. So it could be that this may be something that, you know, would be similar to a feta that had been soaked in salt water and then pressed and maybe aged 6 or 7 months. And I hope Mike finds what he's looking for. Steve will probably be able to help him. Christian's calling. Hey, Christian, what's up?
I have a question for you, Lynn.
Okay.
I have a chef friend of mine. I cooked for about 10 years and I've since left the professional kitchen. But one of the chefs that I worked with was cleaning out his house on his way to a move, opening up the restaurant on the Carolina coast, and gave me a pot. Said, here, Christian, you're the only guy who would use this.
And what kind of pot was it?
It's called a Chinese sand pot.
Oh, boy.
And I know nothing about it. It looks like it could be used for a number of different things. It does have some burn marks on the bottom from being on a stovetop. But I'm kind of at a loss.
Oh, you're talking about, boy, talking about bringing back memories. I used to do a lot of Chinese cooking.
Okay.
And what it's called is a sand pot or a sandy pot.
Mm-hmm.
And is it cracked?
No.
Good. Okay. No. The only reason why is they're very fragile.
Yes. That's why I didn't want to do anything with it first.
Now, if just as an aside, now what this is a clay pot, and it's usually glazed on the inside, not necessarily on the outside. And on the outside, it actually looks like there's sand clinging to it. It has a rough glaze. And it has a lid, and sometimes it has almost like a wire metal frame around it.
Exactly.
And it has a handle, sometimes two handles, sometimes one. And it comes in different sizes. It's for a ton of things, and that's what I wanted to point out. If you don't have the money to go out and spend the fortune that good pots cost, this is the classic braising pot, and I used to buy them for like $10. And the thing about this is it's a braising pot. It's for any dish that needs slow simmering. And there's a whole realm of cooking in the Chinese tradition called sandy pot cooking. These dishes are often things where maybe if there's meat in them or anything that needs browning, it will be done in a metal wok on the stove. And then you add everything to the sandy pot, and you heat a sandy pot very, very, very slowly on the top of the stove.
An oriental crock pot.
Exactly, exactly. And they're charming. And if it's a small one, you can serve maybe two people from it. If it's a bigger one, you can serve a crew. And I used to have little ones. They eventually all got broken in the many moves, but we used to do like individual ones. And you can do things like wonderful braised duck with, whole bok choy cabbages and water chestnuts and ginger and garlic and rice wine and soy sauce. Think stew. Think sandy pot. And there's some classic dishes. There's a marinated or a pickled mustard cabbage that you can buy out of barrels in Chinatowns around the country.
Like a kimchi?
Like almost a kimchi, maybe not as spicy, but sour and sparkly, you know? And you brown chunks of pork shoulder and you put them in your sandy pot with that cabbage, with garlic and with ginger and a little rice wine and soy sauce and broth or water. And you bring it up very, very, very slowly because that's the key with this. If you put it over high heat or whatever, it'll crack.
That's what I surmised with glass of any kind.
Yeah,
and ceramic of any kind.
Right.
Heating it too quickly would definitely do it.
Exactly. And the only thing you have to remember is if you bring it up very gently and very slowly, you get it up to where things are simmering, you cover and you forget about it, or at least you cook it about 2 hours. And everything is melting together. It is the most fun to play with. I've done, years ago, we used to do duck with dried salted plums. It was wonderful. So check out Chinese cookbooks for anything that's braised, and you can do it in your Sandy Pot.
Well, I happen to live in Charlotte's version of Chinatown, the Asian district.
Oh, this is great.
I'm right around the corner from the largest Oriental market in the area. So
I would bet you if you
pick up a duck and some tamarind and some...
Exactly. I would bet, too, if you talk to the vendors and the women in the market, they'd probably give you a ton of recipes.
I think they would. I'll have to bring it over there. That might get a little bit more reaction.
That's right. And just play very dumb,
which
for me has never been difficult in situations like
that.
Nor
I, particularly with the language.
But the thing, too, is one thing to remember about a Sandy Pop, because this happened to me. When you wash them, don't use anything abrasive. You know, just soap and water. But dry it thoroughly. Leave the lid off. Let it sit out. Because I put one away damp once with a lid on, and it got moldy inside.
Yeah, I wouldn't think it would be mildew. In fact, I would think I would have to rinse it out and throw it back in a warm oven to
But remember, in China, people don't have ovens. So this is a stovetop cook pot.
Okay.
And you're right. It's a Chinese crock pot.
Yeah.
Hey, thanks.
Thanks for your help.
I haven't thought about this in a long time.
Well,
thank you.
Well, maybe you get inspired for a good some good meals upcoming.
Hey, thanks, Christian.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
Bye. Jane's calling. Jane, what's up?
Well, Lynn, I was just calling back with an update for you on the pit roasted goat.
You were the
My gourmet club.
Yes. Oh, how did it go? How did it go?
Well, we had some pluses and unfortunately a bit of a minus.
Oh, dear.
But, you know how that can be.
Yeah, but tell me what the minus was first. Let's get that out of the way.
You want to hear the minus first?
Yeah.
We didn't put enough coals on top.
Development and reform. The developing
transition. Oh, no.
So, so that when we brought it out and the grape leaves had turned to ash and we brushed those aside, that side was raw.
Oh, well. So
we
half a goat.
We flipped it over and the other side was well done.
Gee, that's an interesting lesson. I mean, not that all of us are going to run out and do this. I realize this, but so you need a lot of coals on the top.
Yes. In fact, I was thinking about it while I was waiting just now, we probably had 4 or 5 inches on the bottom.
Uh-huh.
And we tried to do it in a hurry, thinking that we had to smother the fire quickly.
Yeah, yeah.
So we very quickly put the goat on, put the fire, put the tarp, and then the dirt on top.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we probably maybe only had a good inch or inch and a half of coals on top.
So for everybody who is charging out to their garden to start digging their pit to roast a kid or a lamb or whatever, remember you need 4 inches or so of coals on top of the thing.
Now, oh, yes.
What were the pluses?
Well, the grapevines were wonderful. That infused the meat with this wonderful flavor. That was just great. That was a real plus. And in the areas where I made the stuffing, I did oregano, garlic, and lemon inside.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, some of it fell out. So I would think next time I would stuff it even more. I feel like I probably couldn't even use too much.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So that was great. We also, my husband made a frame sort of out of chicken wire that we laid the grape leaves and then the goat and then more grape leaves, and he put another piece of chicken wire over that to hold it all together, and then the sides came up about 24 inches, so
uh-huh.
We had two handles to pull it up with.
Hey, he's great.
Yeah.
This is good.
It was very good. It was a wonderful evening, and as I said, the parts that were cooked were great, but definitely I would say make it even on the coals.
Well, this is a good lesson for all of us. And, you know, we laugh about this, but you can do this in a very modest way. You can dig the hole, and as long as the weather's good, you can make that bed of coals that we talked about
mm-hmm.
and do what you did, but do it for, like, a butterfly piece of lamb
mm-hmm.
or a chicken and get all that great taste from grapevines and leaves and that kind of thing. Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks for the help.
Hey, you're welcome. I've never done it. Now learned. We've all learned.
You did really well. Thank you.
Everybody get out there and start digging those holes in the backyard. Roast dinner. Chris is calling. Chris, what do you want to talk about?
Lynn.
Yeah.
I have a dilemma.
Oh, boy. I love dilemmas. Go ahead. I am here. I am here for you.
I am having a huge pregnant craving that I can't get a hold of.
No, wait a minute. Is the craving pregnant or are you?
I'm pregnant. But I would say the craving probably is too.
All right. Okay. How far along are you?
I'm about 3 months.
Uh-huh.
And so most of the time I feel pretty green, but when I do want to eat something, it's corn gravy, and we used to live in Boise, Idaho.
Yeah.
And there was this great little restaurant downtown that served mashed potatoes with the skin still on.
Uh-huh.
And corn gravy over it.
Was it like a brown gravy with corn in it?
No, just clear. Like, almost like it was, see, I used chicken stock the last time I tried to do it.
Uh-huh.
And it just wasn't quite right.
Well, Chris, to tell you the truth now, I just don't have a clue.
But,
No. But that's all right, because now what we'll do is we will apply imagination. You're saying it sounds like it tasted kind of rich, but not rich from cream or fat.
Right.
But rich with real flavor.
Yes.
Maybe what you want to do is do something like brown in a pan in a little butter, celery, carrot, onion, and if you have a few little pieces of chicken thigh, or you've got bits of beef, some little amount of meat. I don't mean more than about 4 ounces.
Uh-huh.
Okay. Brown that over like medium heat and take 20 minutes to brown it, because that'll build up a real lush brown flavor. Salt and pepper it. Throw in a bay leaf. Okay.
Okay.
If you wanted to add parsley, you could. Then add your broth. And add your broth, add like a cup and boil it down to nothing.
Okay.
Add another cup, boil it down to nothing. Add a third cup and boil it down to nothing. Now you are now doing a very fancy sounding thing. It's called a multiple reduction over a brown base.
Okay.
But the fact is, you're building this real depth of taste. Then you could stir a little bit of cornstarch, like a teaspoon or so of cornstarch and a tablespoon of cold water. Okay, and add a couple of cups of the broth. Simmer that couple of cups of broth about 10, 15 minutes. Taste it. See if it's the way you like it. Then stir in corn and stir in that thickener and just boil it about a minute, because what will happen is it'll get cloudy and then it'll kind of clear.
Okay.
And you should have something that maybe comes closer to that gravy you remember.
Oh, I hope so.
Do you know what's going to happen, Chris? You are going to conquer this recipe. You're going to make it, and then your cravings will move on to something else.
Something totally different. Yeah.
Exactly. And when that happens, call us.
Okay, I'll do that.
Hey, thank you.
Thank you so much.
And stay well.
You too. Bye-bye.
Goodbye. Hey, everybody, thanks for calling, and be sure to join us next week. In the meantime, let me leave you with an observation from writer Clement Freud. If eels only looked a little less like eels, more people would want to eat them. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Club Wed Gift Registry at Target, featuring Henkel's top-of-the-line, fully-forged professional cutlery. Henkel's is the knife choice of many professional chefs. To get a copy of the Stern's Roadside Food Finds and Alice Waters' recipe for brine-cured pork, simply mail a self-addressed stamped envelope to The Splendid Table, care of Minnesota Public Radio, St. Paul, Minnesota, 55101. That's The Splendid Table, care of MPR, St. Paul, Minnesota, 55101. Or take a look at our website, splendidtable.org. The Splendid Table is produced by Jennifer Russell and Sally Swift. The associate producer is Jennifer Lubke. The theme music is by Billy Barber. The Splendid Table is produced by Minnesota Public Radio and Tom Bagley Productions. Be sure to join us next week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
Public Radio International.